broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network. This is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. I'm glad you could be with us. Today we have in studio Drug Truth Network reporter, Mr. Tony King. He's about 10 days out of a prison sentence here in Texas. And we'll also hear from Gary S. Becker, the Nobel laureate, world-renowned economist. I got a chance to do an interview with him about a week ago, and I was so starstruck, even though I was 20 years an accountant and basically an economist, I blew it. He told me he'd do a longer interview with us later, and we will be doing that. But we do have a short interview specifically about the drug war with Mr. Gary Becker. But first up, we have a Drug Truth Network editorial. Who are the drug lords, the administrators of the smuggling cartels who live lives of luxury in Bogota, Kabul, and Mexico City? The upper echelons, the enablers, live in D.C., New York, London, and Houston. Who are the drug lords, the real kingpins? They are bankers, pharmaceutical houses, oil companies, construction companies, weapons manufacturers, and a host of other corporate interests whose very existence depends on violence, hatred, distrust, and deception. The prohibition of drugs is the ideal means to continuously ratchet up the rhetoric. The drug lords make untold billions each year from the drug war. Make no mistake about that. The farm gate price of these illegal drugs is less than $5 billion per year. In the U.S. alone, we spend well in excess of $50 billion per year attempting to squelch the flow of drugs and in housing 2.2 million prisoners and in arresting 1.6 million additional U.S. citizens each year for baggies of plant products. The UN estimates the worldwide commerce in these illegal drugs to be $500 billion per year. Chicken feed compared to the amounts made by the upper echelon whose gravy is ladled with steam shovels. The bankers take up to 80% of the drug take when they launder the money for cocaine cartels and marijuana magnates. The oil companies are able to easily usurp lands once the peasant farmers use them for coca production. Prior to 1914 and the passage of the Harrison Narcotics Act, Bayer heroin was on the grocer's shelf next to Bayer aspirin at the same price. And by the way, aspirin still kills more people each year than all the concoctions made by illegal chemists. The pharmaceutical houses and the medical associations decided in the early 20th century that the American people could be forced to give up their right to decide for themselves what to put into their own bodies. If it's not made by a Fortune 500 company, it's a crime on planet Earth. Before 9/11, we were already spending in excess of $400 billion per year to provide security for our nation. Following our crusades to Afghanistan and Iraq too, not to mention our presence in about 140 of the 170 nations on planet Earth, we are now spending approximately $800 billion per year to feel secure. President Eisenhower warned us as he was leaving office to be aware of the military-industrial complex. Who are the drug lords? They are every politician who lives and breathes war, drugs, terror, or otherwise. They are the corrupt, lying corporate heads, malicious media barons, venomous judges, and cretinous cops who, knowing full well the truth, choose to follow their nose to riches, to embrace a lie, to feed their evil cornucopia with the lives of their fellow man. Who are the drug lords? Knowing what you do about this policy of prohibition, if you don't work to bring this tower of drug war madness crashing to the ground, your silence is far from golden. We gave up our liberty to choose our own medicines in 1914 in exchange for supposed security regarding drugs. In 2006, we are being forced to give up additional, even unknown, liberties in exchange for supposed protection. Our slide into this abyss is facilitated by the fear engendered by 92 years of prohibition and the mechanism of deceit that allows the drug war to flourish despite decades of miserable failure. America, land of the free, home of the brave, my observations indicate we are at a cusp, a junction where we can choose liberty, truth, and justice, or we can slide into the arms of Big Brother, admitting we are powerless over our own lives and are willing to take whatever the drug lords are offering. I hope you are willing to stand. I know you understand. I talk to people on a daily basis who agree 100% we're right, we need to make the change. And yet if you do nothing, truthfully, you are supporting this policy. I did mention Gary S. Becker. He's a world-renowned economist, Nobel laureate, well-respected, and he sees this drug war as a miserable failure. Let's go ahead and play that cut from Gary S. Becker.
Professor Becker, this drug war is economically a fiasco, am I right?
Absolutely. It's been costly, not very largely ineffective. And the cost, if you add it up, not only in dollars and cents, but effects on neighborhoods and countries, has been enormous. So I think we have to recognize that, and we've been reluctant to do so.
If I dare say, the reluctance of those in power, the legislators, to stop and take the time to look at this situation is outrageous, is it not?
Well, I wish it were different. You know, I'm accustomed to political changes being often very difficult, and I think any objective analysis of the benefits and costs would show the costs of this war far exceed the benefits I indicated earlier. Now, the politicians usually respond to the electorate, and unfortunately, I think a lot of the population has been opposed to the war on drugs, and that's the group we first have to educate, and then I think that will influence the politicians.
You know, you do a poll, they do Scripps Howard polls, etc. People in regards to marijuana and or medical marijuana, and the numbers are always hugely in favor of a change. What does it take to reach the federal level? They recently said that sick and dying patients can't have marijuana.
Yeah, well, I think it's often the problem with public policy that you may have a majority in favor of a particular change, but it isn't as important to them, and a minority is very vocal and active who put more pressure, and they can have more influence, even though if you did maybe a straight referendum or something of that type, let's say the marijuana would be legalized for at least a variety of purposes and the like. So I think as an economist who's been active for many years and seen important changes in public policy in areas where it seemed would not be possible previously, I still believe that the logic of decriminalizing, legalizing drugs is so strong that we will see an important change. But it takes activities by people like you, yourself, and academics and others at all different levels to really push on this issue. But I'm not pessimistic because I think it takes time to affect any significant change in the public policy, and that's what's happening, I think, in the drug case.
You know, we had Milton Friedman, another Nobel laureate, on I guess middle of last year. We bring you judges, congressmen, you know, Canadian senators, members of the European Parliament, authors, doctors, scientists, people who have been in the trenches of the drug war, people who understand this. But I think people in prison need to be listened to as well. People who have seen the drug war from that side. And over the years, you've heard our reporter, Mr. Tony King, with his reports from the outside and his reports from the inside, talking about this drug war. And I'm proud to welcome him to the studio. Hello, Tony.
Thank you, Dave. It's good to be here.
Tony, I guess this was the third time twice for urinating too many nanograms, apparently. That's what they said, right?
Right.
And the first time for an eight ball, a minor amount that was left in a car you were driving. And what has it done to you and your family over these approximate 2 years now?
Well, over the last 2 years, my whole life's changed. Before that, everything was just fine. I had a truck, had a house, had a car, had a station wagon, had two beautiful kids. You know, everything was just right. Then all of a sudden, this little mishap happened, and my whole life's been torn apart. I was with my wife about 27 years. We're no longer together because partly because of this. My children's lives have been totally turned upside down because of it. They've seen things happen and not understood why they happen, and I try to explain to them the best of my ability with the knowledge that I have of how come these things happened with me that they did. I was locked up, sentenced to 3 years TDC. Spent my time in TDC, got out. Like you said, I had two violations. Now, in October, I went to a hearing because when I got out in February, I was given to a parole officer that considered me a waste of his time, considered me really unworthy to even be part of the general population out in society. He told me when I got home that I would probably, to the best of his ability, he would do everything he could to send me back. Well, it took him until October to satisfy his need to take control of my life and, you know, keep my life turned into turmoil. And I went to a hearing on October 18th, and in the middle of my hearing, he realized that I probably was going to walk that day and go home, and pending the decision on the Board of Pardons and Parole in Austin, until they decided whether they were going to sentence me to 60 days ISF or if they were going to reinstate my parole. So he went out and took a recess and went out and told the Harris County Sheriff that runs the wing there where they have the hearings at, he wanted a blue warrant put out for my arrest. So he put a blue warrant out for my arrest, and when I got up to leave after my hearing, the sheriff asked me to come back to the back room, and I went back there. And that's when I realized then that he was fixing to take my freedom from me and lock me up, waiting the decision on what they were going to decide.
Well, Tony, it occurs to me a parole officer is not there. He's not an arresting officer. He's not an informant. He's not. His job is not to send you back to prison on a minor violation. His job is to encourage you. His job, is that not right? I mean, his job is to keep you on the outside rather than making sure you go back.
Right. The way I understand it, a parole officer's job, from information that I gathered before I got out and after I got out, was that a parole officer's job is to help you with your reentry into society to be as smooth as possible, to be there for you if you did stumble and have a fall or make a mistake or have an accident of some kind or do something foolish that was not a really terrible thing to happen. He is there to help you smooth the rough edges and to help you, you know, re-enter back into society in a positive way. And that's not what happened to me the first time.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to take a little break here, and it'll maybe give us some talking points. Let's see. Let's go ahead and play that if we can, Philip.
Hey, this is Tommy Chong for the Cultural Baggage Show, telling everybody out there, don't let free speech go up in smoke, man.
Drug Czar of the Americas, John Walters.
Marijuana may not cause the overdose deaths like heroin, but it's just as dangerous.
For as long as man has been recording history, marijuana has shown itself to be of great benefit in fighting anxiety. It's time to play Name That Drug by its side effects. Anorexia, nausea, insomnia, constipation, or diarrhea and loose stools, agitation, tremors, decreased libido, and failure to ejaculate. Time's up. The answer, Zoloft.
Another FDA-approved product.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of Drug Sense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
I'm hungry.
George W. Bush and suppression of medical cannabis is killing vastly more people and causing vastly more human suffering than even Saddam Hussein could in his worst days. And this is something that the cannabis movement and the peace movement and progressive people every place have to address. If they aren't addressing medical cannabis, they are ignoring something that has an enormous impact on millions of people. Well, if they're too serious to, they can't talk about mass murder, then they have their priorities all screwed up.
Richard Cowan. CannabisNews.com.
You know, Tony, over the months, past couple of months, we got reports from you. We talked about the Harris County Jail in particular, how it was overcrowded, people sleeping on concrete, drinking water from the back of the toilet. Did you see any changes while you were there?
No, the only thing I saw was there was one guy that was locked up with him that MHMR was monitoring and stuff, and they put him in general population with the rest of us, and he really had no business being locked up in county jail. As far as the facility itself, I think something scared him a little bit because they were making a lot of cleanup efforts. They were cleaning the showers about once every week with bleaching them down and cleaning them like they should have been doing. If they would give us the products, we would have done it ourselves. I've been locked up long enough that I keep my place clean. I know that if I'm going to be around that many guys, that I want to keep my place clean because I want to minimize my chances of getting sick or getting diseases or anything else, along those lines. But they were cleaning up everything else, but the population in Harris County Jail is atrocious. The meals are, you wouldn't feed the meals to anybody. The meals, they're not satisfactory. There's not enough food in those trays to feed a grown man. Yet, I'm sure they get plenty of funds in order to be able to do that. But
well, before the show started, we were talking, and you had mentioned that the day or two before you were arrested this last time, you had developed a tooth problem, and that you were in 30-40 days this last time?
I was in 93 days total.
I was
in Harris County Jail for 72 days. I'd been sentenced to 60 days ISF. I was supposed to get out on December 26th, and my new parole officer had already been by my house. The 26th was a federal holiday, so nobody worked. So my paperwork didn't get done. So on December 28th, they pulled me out on chain to send me to the North Texas Intermediate Sanction Facility, which is ISF. It's a giant, huge warehouse that they used to build trailers in, and now it's a incarceration facility. It's halfway between county jail and Texas Department of Criminal Justice. And I was there for 3 weeks to have my home address reapproved. So they shipped me 5.5 hours up to Fort Worth, turned around after 3 weeks because I went to the same place that I'd lived at, same address since 1972. And they know that. Everybody knew that. The hearing officer at my hearing knew that. I signed the papers and filled them out at that time. So I went through that process 3 times. And then on, I think it was January the 19th, they sent me back to Houston in a total of 93 days that I was locked up.
Now, considering that they are supposed to take care of their prisoners, their medical needs, did you ever get the tooth fixed while you were in there?
No, I've not got the tooth fixed, and as soon as I got home, I went right back to work because my employer understands me, counts on me, and believes enough in me that I went right back to work. Hopefully I'll get it taken care of this weekend. I'm taking some medication that I just got from the doctor. Like I said, that's the thing. So now we're talking, about 104 days now. And they knew of the problem, never took care of the problem, never helped me address the problem correctly. And I may end up having to miss work Monday to get it taken care of, but it's a dental issue that has to be done.
I hear you, man. Well, again, that shows their lack of respect, I think, for the people they're housing. Tony, I know some of the prisons are able to hear our shows. I get letters from prisoners talking about it, and I want to thank our reporters, Glenn Greenway, who does our Poppygate report, and Doug McVeigh, who does our Drug War Facts.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
Every day, as the Bush administration smirks, winks, and nods, Afghanistan quietly produces another 20 million hits of heroin. During Super Bowl 36, in which the Patriots beat the Rams 20-17, the White House famously unveiled a new campaign linking drugs to terrorist funding. This week, Afghan President Hamid Karzai echoed this theme as he announced that drugs are funding an unprecedented wave of suicide bombings in his country. On January 15th, senior Canadian diplomat Glenn Berry was killed in such an attack near Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. In 2004, Republican U.S. Representative Mark Stephen Kirk of Illinois said, quote, "It seems clear to me heroin is the number one financial asset of Osama bin Laden," end quote. Since last week's Poppygate report, the Bush administration has once again been taunted by Osama while overseeing the production of another 140 million hits of Afghan heroin. One wonders, how much terror will last year's estimated 7 billion hits buy? This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
Next time an official tells you methamphetamine abuse is out of control and we need to start getting tough, consider this. In 1995, the Drug Czar's office co-sponsored the National Methamphetamine Drug Conference in Omaha, Nebraska, in response to reports of growing methamphetamine use and production in parts of the U.S. where the drug had not previously been known to be used. Then in 1996, the president signed into law the Comprehensive Methamphetamine Control Act. In 1998, the Methamphetamine Trafficking Penalty Enhancement Act became part of law as part of an omnibus appropriations bill. 2000, the Methamphetamine Club Drug Anti-Proliferation Act became Title 36 of the Children's Health Act. In 2004, the National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws put out its Model State Chemical Control Act, which included ephedrine and pseudoephedrine in its list of regulated chemicals. The Alliance's website currently lists 36 states, which now have similar restrictions. Recent reports show that though there are fewer home meth cooks, use has not diminished. Mexican meth, particularly ice, is becoming more widely available instead. We've been waging a losing conventional drug war against methamphetamine for more than a decade. More cops, more laws, tougher penalties, yet more meth use and more failure. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Okay, you are listening to Cultural Baggage on the Drug Truth Network. I'm here with Tony King, the Drug Truth Network reporter. Tony, there's a lot of people in jail, a lot of people in prison, am I right? Who did you meet while you're in there? What was their reason?
Most of the people were in there for technical violations. While I was locked up this last time at ISF, there's a lot of people in there for technical violations, anywhere from changing their address and not filling out the proper paperwork, even though the parole officer may have known they didn't fill out the proper paperwork, for dirty UA, got caught in a bar drinking a beer. Simple little things, and you know, right, it's part of our parole that we can't be around any drugs, can't be around any alcohol, can't be around anything else of that nature while we're on parole, while we're being monitored. So any little technical violation that we do, anything that we have that we get out of line with, they consider it a technical violation, and it only takes two technical violations to send you back to a sanctioned facility of one sort or another.
But the main reason that they were charged in the first place, what?
Probably about 85% were on drug charges. Most of them were either cocaine charges or marijuana charges. And it's crazy because I never knew I even had ADHD until I had to quit smoking marijuana when I was on probation before I ever got in any major trouble. So, you know, marijuana, I'm 51 years old, and I'm a responsible person in society, and what I choose to do in my own home, I feel like that's my own thing to do. The problem with the parole department is anything you do wrong, they get you.
Well, that's for sure. I'm glad to report that Phil Jackson will be doing his reports for us on a weekly basis.
And now another black perspective on the drug war. Have you ever been a victim of crime? I have. I've come home to find my apartment burglarized. All of my belongings gone without a trace. It's a terrible feeling. And as I stood there in my empty apartment, I wondered, as many do at such times, why didn't somebody do something? Where are all the cops when you need one? Last year, more than 770,000 people were arrested for marijuana. And of that, 750,000 arrests, 90% were for simple possession. Now, how many cops does it take to capture, transport, process, document, and warehouse 770,000 people? How many cop hours does it take to prosecute not drug dealers, but just drug users? I don't know, but I suspect it's a lot. What I do know, though, what I am absolutely crystal clear on, is that if I had been given the choice that day of whether to use the police resources available to catch pot smokers or to investigate residential burglary, I'd have had them out looking for my stuff. 770,000 arrests is impressive, but I would be much more impressed if it were 770,000 car thieves, muggers, con artists, embezzlers, child molesters, burglars, even pickpockets. There are people who need to be arrested, people who endanger my home, my family, my property, and my community. Pot smokers aren't even on the list. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
Phil always has a very strong telling point to make, and I thank him for that. Tony King has been our guest today here on the Cultural Baggage Show. Tony, I want to thank you for being with us. And
it's a pleasure to be here.
We'll look forward to future reports from you. I think the main thing I've learned from all this is that in every way, this drug war has no basis in reality. The attempt to, you know, provide supervision has been a fiasco as well. There's no justification for it at all. Let's go ahead and run that PSA. I want folks to hear this. I want them to think about becoming a medical marijuana activist.
This is novelist Tom Robbins. When my mother was diagnosed with glaucoma, her doctor told her only one treatment might save her eyesight, medical marijuana, which he could not prescribe. Because medical marijuana was against the law, my mother went blind. Tragedies like this don't have to keep happening. To learn more about medical marijuana, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or on the web at mpp.org.
Well, I promise that when I call Gary S. Becker back, I'll have my questions written down so I don't screw that pooch. You know, folks, it's really up to you. You can visit our website, which is endprohibition.org, and there you can link up with about 15 of the best drug reform organizations out there. You know, it's not often that I encounter anyone who believes anything about the drug war. The truth is obvious, glaring. It's in your face, and I wish you'd help win this battle. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag, and I urge you to please be careful.
To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Jack dancing on the edge of cannabis.